Becky was born and raised in California. She received a bachelor's degree from Brigham Young University while at the same time receiving her licensed practical nursing degree. Becky worked as a nurse at several hospitals, then left the workforce to be a stay-at-home mom. She is currently a consultant for an ambulatory surgery center, Davies Surgical Eye Center in Carlsbad. She is also serving on the Macy's Advisory Board in San Diego and has been doing so since 2013. Becky wrote the curriculum for the Liberty Project, a nonpartisan community class on the Constitution and founding principles. This year, her class was taught at 7 locations throughout the San Diego region. Becky is currently the Director of Public Affairs for the San Diego region for the LDS Church. She is married to Jim Davies, an ophthalmologist, with an office surgery center that's also located in Carlsbad. She is the mother of 7 children and has almost 17 grandchildren. And we'll turn the time over to Becky now for her presentation.
Thank you. I'm still trying to wrap my mind around 98 grandchildren. I'm going to have to figure out how that works. And announcement, we have one more grandchild on the way. Just found out. So, and this is not on the right spot here. Is it going to work if I have it upside down? Okay. All right. I'm so happy to be here today and have the opportunity to talk to you about one of the things I love to talk about most. And that is what Founding Fathers knew, because they do a lot more than we know today, unfortunately. But we're hoping to change that. I'm also very impressed that you meet together. Matt Ball got me into this. He spoke here with us a couple of months ago. And I'm impressed that you meet together to talk about great people, what they've done, and be inspired by them, because I don't think we see enough of that today, people wanting to be inspired by greatness. And it's fascinating to me that every time you find someone who's truly great, and I think you'll know this, they don't think they're great. They never did think they were great. And that's actually one way you know that they truly are great. So the basis of their greatness is not in really what they've done. It's really in who they've become. And that holds specifically true for the founders, who did some incredible things and never thought they were great, but they were part of a great vision about being able to create a country. And if you think about this, the first in all the history of the earth to have a group of people who reasoned together, had a vision, and that they were the first ones to be founded on working together to create a nation. It wasn't created after war, wasn't created after anarchy. It was created because a group of people got together and made decisions, reasoned together, and formed a nation on governing themselves. And that had never happened before. The founders were successful because of one really important thing, and that was because they shared a similar worldview. So no two in this room have the same worldview, but we might be similar. But the worldview is critical. What you believe is what you become, right? And so our worldview can be established on how we were raised, or by popular culture, or by college education, or by actively pursuing truth, figuring out what your worldview is going to be. When I was, I homeschooled the last 3 of my kids, and I taught a class where we had the youth, age 16, write their worldviews, which I'm sure probably, has anyone ever written their worldview before in this room? It was a very powerful thing. They had 10 areas, and we wanted to know their worldview in each, because that formed really a complete worldview, and they had to have proofs. When they got finished, some of these worldviews were like 50 pages long. Do you think that they had a pretty solid, even though that'll morph over time, pretty solid idea of who they were, what they believed, and what kind of an impact that would have in their lives? Worldviews change, as I said, over a lifetime. There's a university professor, and I love this, who said to his students, "The only proof you have a mind is that you change it every once in a while when confronted with an argument better than yours." And that's really what happens with our worldviews. Our culture often exhibits something that we can call the chronological arrogance, and that's the belief, I did it, maybe some of you are still doing it, that we are automatically, because we're modern, we're automatically more enlightened than those people in the past. We assume that we're better because they are old news, we're modern, more civilized, they were farmers, and we're educated. I used to think that, but then, how many of you have read, now I know that all lawyers have read this, but how many of you have read the Federalist Papers? Just a few. It's hard reading, and I'm here to tell you that few Americans could pick that up today and make any sense of it, but it was read by the average farmers, shopkeepers, and housewives of the founders' time. One historical writer said, "Such are the heights of arrogance and the depths of ignorance which have dismembered the collective mind and the memory of contemporary culture as America cuts itself off from the wisdom of the very founders who instilled the values and developed the institutions which not only made its prosperity and pleasures possible, but whose corruption they predicted and in terms which often precisely resemble that which we observe with our own eyes today." So no person is above their own worldview, so wanting those worldviews to be at heights that we can reach during our lifetime would be really important. In Proverbs it says, as a man thinketh, so is he. That's why the worldview is so critical. So they searched for truths, the founders did, in nature. They tested historical experience. They were incredibly well-read, in ancient languages even, and gained knowledge by reason and by revelation. And our obligation is to understand the founders as they understood themselves. So the founders' worldview was based, if we were to distill it, if you've done enough reading, into three different areas that were critical for them. And that is, number one, the understanding of human nature. Number two, their ideal of ordered liberty and their belief in public and private virtue. Those three things. The founders, whether religious or not, don't you love this picture? They adopted the Judeo-Christian concept of man's dual nature. So his dignity and his depravity, his greatness and his wickedness. And they believed that man was always driven by selfish motives but was capable of rising above that. There was a dark side to mankind that always had to be kept in check. And they believed in man's worth as recognized by the Creator, and we know that from the Declaration of Independence, that required his unalienable rights to be respected, and that they would also respect others. So we know this quote by James Madison, "But what is government itself but the greatest of all reflections on human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external or internal controls on government would be necessary." So human nature, this is a quote by Jefferson. He had a very realistic idea. He said, "You can force nature out the front door with a pitchfork, but it will gallop through the back door before you can turn around." People are not born with the ability to govern themselves. It is learned behavior. And the founder said that there were three main places where that had to be learned. And that was the family, religion, and schools, if they were healthy. And Abigail Adams said that a true patriot must be a religious man. There's an account, and I love this. You know, we don't know how many of these apocryphal stories are true, but I love this, and I want to believe it's true. That Washington, this is Washington's introduction to God, that his father went out into their farm, you know, they were farmers, and he planted cabbage seeds in the name, to spell his son's name, George. And then when they grew up enough that he could see the pattern, George was astounded by what he saw, and his father said to him, "This is a great thing. I want you to understand that I am introducing you to your true father, the source and sustenance to all life." Is that beautiful? Whether it's true or not, it's beautiful. Contrary to many who spend their time today disparaging the founders and claim that they were scarcely religious deists, I would challenge you to read their writings. And you will know in their own words that they were deeply religious men and women. So just to give you an example, Benjamin Franklin came up with the 5 points of fundamental religious belief. They are recognition. This is what he said over the broad spectrum of the colonial peoples. That number one, they recognized and they had a worship of a creator who made all things. That the creator revealed a moral code of behavior that distinguishes between right and wrong. That the creator holds mankind responsible for the way they treat each other. That all mankind live beyond this life, and in the next life we will be judged by our conduct in this life. And that was the basis for all religion, no matter what denomination, at the time of the founders. John Adams said our Constitution was made for only a moral and a religious people, and it's wholly inadequate to the government of any other. So why is that? Because they believe that fundamental, what we just talked about with Benjamin Franklin, fundamental religious beliefs are the greatest influence for the development of moral values needed to be able to strengthen each individual's ability to be able to govern their human nature and keep it under control. So I'm going to ask you a question and see how you would answer this. We're going to check your morality. So who would you save? Your dog or a stranger? So I'm going to show you. Mike Slater is on the radio. He's a friend of ours down in San Diego, and he did this fun little thing on the beach, a dog beach down in San Diego.
So if a bus was hurtling down the street, and it was going to hit either a foreign tourist or one of your dogs, and you could only save one, which would you save?
My dog.
And you can only save one. Who do you save?
I gotta save my dog, Bettabell.
My dog.
I gotta save my dog. I'm sorry.
The dog.
Either a foreign tourist or Molly. Who do you save?
Molly.
Who do you think the human would say?
Well, they would be hit.
What country?
My dog, obviously.
French tourist.
French tourist, yes, to Molly.
Even though it's a human, but my dog's part of the family, so.
If it was a distant cousin or your dog, who would you choose? The bus is coming real fast, buddy.
Okay, I guess I would say maybe the cousin.
What about the human?
I'd make an attempt for him right after, Stewie. Good.
Either a foreign tourist or Waldo, and you can only save one. Who do you save?
Definitely Waldo. Not a question.
What do you think?
I don't know.
Which do you say?
Foreign tourist. Easy.
A distant cousin or your dog.
Oh, no. So, I'm sorry. I would rather save my dog than the foreign tourist.
Probably the dog, because a distant cousin, I probably don't know him as well as I know my dog.
What if it was your best friend or the dog?
I hate to say it, but the dog.
What if it's a distant cousin?
Nah.
Best friend or Molly?
Teresa.
Wow, do
she can save herself.
Either a foreign tourist or a foster, and you can only save one. Who do you save?
The foreign tourist.
Why the tourist?
Because I like human life.
Do you love your dog?
Yeah.
And you would still choose the human?
Yeah.
Can I give you a hug, sir?
Okay.
One. Okay, and then this.
Are you more valuable than a dog or a cat, or for that matter, a tree? One of the biggest differences between Judeo-Christian values and secular values concerns this very issue, the worth of the human being. According to the Judeo-Christian value system, human beings are infinitely valuable. On the other hand, secular humanism devalues the worth of humans. As ironic as it may sound, the God-based Judeo-Christian value system renders humans infinitely more valuable than any humanistic value system. The reason is simple. If there is no God, human beings are only material beings, and therefore not worth anything beyond the matter of which they are composed. But in the Judeo-Christian system, human beings are created in the image of God, meaning that human life is sacred. In other words, we are either created in the image of carbon atoms, and therefore not worth much more than carbon, or we are created in the image of God, and therefore infinitely valuable. Our secular post-Judeo-Christian society has rendered human beings less significant than at any time in Western history. First, the secular denial that human beings are created in God's image has led to humans increasingly being equated with animals. That's why, over the course of 30 years of asking high school and college students if they would first try to save their dog or a stranger, two-thirds have always voted against the person. They either don't know what they would do, or they actually vote for the dog. And many adults now vote similarly. Why? There are two reasons. One is that, with the denial of the authority of higher values, such as religious teachings, people increasingly make moral decisions on the basis of how they feel. And since just about everybody feels more for their dog than for a stranger, many people simply choose the dog. The other reason is that once you get rid of Judeo-Christian values, there's no reason for elevating human worth over that of an animal.
Okay, I'm going to race through this part, but at Princeton a few years ago, a documentary filmmaker and a historian were invited to speak to a class of a professor there, and about a film that they had done on Washington. And they taught that Washington came to be who he was because he imagined an ideal, a truly noble individual, and then he spent his whole life to become that person. The historian said, do you know why, and this is a side question, do you know why Washington was almost unanimously chosen as the general, even though there were several very much more qualified generals that were available, like Lee and Horatio Gates? He had never led anything more than a regiment before. But it was because Adams nominated him. He was chosen by Congress because, quote, he could not be bribed, corrupted, or compromised. And in this situation, as they talked about this ideal that Washington, they were teaching the students this, students, about half the class, became really upset about the content and said that they believed on that basis that Washington was inauthentic, that he was putting on an act his whole life, that he pretended to be what he was not, that instead of affirming and following his desires in life, he tried to become something he was not. And that really disturbed the professor, and he said he was able to, after giving a lot of thought to this, to kind of create two groups in his mind, and I found that I see the same thing. One he called the soul group, and the other called the self group. And that the soul group believes in a power higher than themselves, and that true authenticity comes from moral choices that you make where you actually grow and become something, an ideal. And the self group believes that authenticity is found in unrestrained expression of desires, that if you feel it, you've got to do it, because that's who you are. And that anything else, any kind of other kind of restraint holds you back from who you truly are, which is really a fascinating study on humankind. The next one is the ideal of that the founders were concerned with is the ideal of ordered liberty. And we first have to know what liberty is, which we think we all know that just means freedom, but the two words are very different. Freedom means self-determination, the state of free will, and being exempt from bondage. That's it. Do what you want to do. It's my life. That's the true root of freedom. Liberty is different. Liberty is not just the absence of bondage, but the fitness of an individual to act rightly in accordance with truth, doing what you ought to do, which takes education, for one thing, and some sort of moral education. So liberty is not license or just free will. It means that we act with moral responsibility. And ordered liberty, means the actions are consistent with the laws of nature and nature's God. And we get that phrase from the Declaration of Independence. Because there are no natural masters and no natural slaves out there. Everybody has a natural liberty to order their life without interference with other people as long as they don't interfere with someone else's liberty. The founders believe that ordered liberty was founded on a written constitution. Did you know Great Britain still does not have a written constitution? They believe that's really important, that it could be known. Our constitution is short. It can be read and understood if you have a dictionary today. But above that law, constitutional law, was an unwritten higher law called natural law. And that law was rooted in the moral order of the universe. And not merely created by man, but that it was all mankind through their conscience, and which Washington called the celestial fire, that they could know the order of life. And this explains the importance of the Declaration of Independence that states that, and that the laws, that the rights and liberty come from laws of nature and nature's God, and that means that the rights of life existed before government, before any government, just like gravity did. And that they were established by our Creator, and we are duty-bound to respect the same rights in others. So the moral order, you can see from this, the right and wrong, correct and incorrect based on being based in truth, moral and immoral being based on natural law. And then we have the other part of this, which we have moral order and moral relativism, which we see a lot today, that my truth is what I say it is, which becomes very, very difficult because anyone who claims that they have their truth, it's going to be in conflict with someone else's truth, right? So the moral vision of the founders was intended to inspire the citizens to their God-given natural rights and helping them to overcome their self-interest by self-discipline, self-control. And so this idea of ordered liberty gave the founding generation a sense of something we talk about disparagingly today, this American exceptionalism. It wasn't that America, that we're just all so wonderful and we have never done anything wrong here in America. It's the belief that America, the idea of America is exceptional, is a noble experiment in self-government based on national standard of principles. That's why it's the basis, the principles that are exceptional. And they had they put this forth as the ideal, but they had one main concern, and that is, were the people good enough? And could they do this? And they established an order or a form of government, which everyone says today is a democracy, not a democracy. It's a democratic form of government. It is a republic. Make sure you always say that when you're out there. A republic requires virtue in the people. The reason being that the central or national government is limited, as we know. It's chained down by the Constitution to only specific things that it's allowed to do, and that allows for more individual freedom. If you have people who are misbehaving, you're going to have a stronger, larger, more coercive government. And so for the founders, the best way for people to retain as much liberty as possible and negate the need for government intervention or coercion was for them to behave as much as possible as if they didn't need a government to control them. But trying to control human nature is difficult. So the solution, of course, is self-government, self-imposed system of morality, and they believe that religion provided the greatest overall encouragement for that. Montesquieu, who's the person who gave the philosopher, who gave us the separation of powers, the three branches of government, those ideas, he said, when people have good morals, laws become simple. You even see that in a family, don't you? James Madison said, to suppose that any form of government will secure liberty or happiness without any virtue in the people is a chimerical or fictional idea. The founders believed that liberty rested on three great supports. Knowledge of our unalienable rights come from God. Have we lost this today? Yeah. Most people don't know that. And it's written right in the Declaration. A written constitution, government of laws, not men. We are becoming a government of men, not laws. And three, virtue among the people. Those three things. Does anyone know who Robert P. George is? No, you need to know this man. He's a professor of jurisprudence at Princeton University. He said, the founders were under no illusions about the possibility of having a successful scheme of ordered liberty without there being some substantial virtue in the people themselves. And they knew virtue could not be ordered by government. It couldn't be produced by economic system. It couldn't be dictated by a judge. They knew that the virtue needed for constitutional government, for ordered liberty, would be provided by individuals themselves with the assistance of what we call the institutions of civil society, beginning with the marriage-based family, our religious institutions, and our schools when they are healthy. But Plato had something important to say about character and character formation, and I love this. That the project of human life is overcoming what is perhaps the most abject form of slavery, the slavery to one's own desires, the slavery to oneself. As Plato put it, the goal is to achieve proper order in the soul so that the rational part of the self has control over the passions, end of quote. So if I were to choose one thing in all the reading that I've done, one principle that seemed to be more important to the founders than any other, it would be virtue. And it's all throughout their writings. They studied Aristotle in Greek and said, has anyone read the Nicomachean Ethics or however you pronounce it? It's a little bit harder read, but it's excellent read. Aristotle had a lot of things correct. And he said that happiness is an activity of the human soul in accordance with excellence and virtue, with the idea that you cannot have true happiness in life unless you are virtuous. Our modern notion of happiness would not have been the same idea that the founders had. So we have to look at words too. We think of it as personal success or personal pleasure. That's happiness, right? But for them, happiness was the result of having fulfilled one's obligations to oneself and others. In other words, spending their life doing what they ought to do. So Jefferson said, individual happiness shall be inseparable from the practice of virtue, and without virtue, happiness cannot be. And the word virtue, I love this too, the word virtue comes from the Latin virtus, and it means manly strength. But the manly strength that they're really talking about is the kind of manly strength that God has. That when you have that kind of manly, God manly, divine strength within you, that you are able and capable of pushing down your own personal desires for the taking care of other people's needs. So what did the founders mean by virtue? And this is the most concise I've found definition of what they believed. Virtue is the elevation of reason over passion, which results from the voluntary submission of one's behavior to divinely transcendent and universally binding moral obligations to oneself and others, resulting in the greatest possible degree of human liberty, happiness, and flourishing for individuals and societies. And so they believe that the catalyst for all this was religious belief. Not that they would dictate to any person what they should believe, but they needed to have a belief in a higher power. Abigail Adams said, the only sure and permanent foundation of virtue is religion. Let this important truth be engraven upon your heart. But they talked about two different parts to virtue. And public virtue was the willingness to subordinate their own personal self-interest to the needs of others. And there's a phrase by Gandhi which sounds very, very much like scripture found in New Testament. Gandhi said, the best way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. The founding fathers raised the standard of public virtue when they signed their names to a treasonous document. with the phrase, "With firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor." So public virtue means sacrifice, sacrifice of our time and our talents, our possessions, and sometimes even life. The founders knew there was another important truth. There is no public virtue without private virtue. It does not exist. There's no separation between private morality and public morality. If a man is not moral in his private dealings, there's no reason to believe he'll be moral in his dealings in the public. John Adams said, "Public virtue cannot exist in a nation without private, and public virtue is the only foundation for republics." There must be a positive passion for the public good, the public interest, honor, power, glory, established in the minds of people, or there can be no republican government nor any real liberty. And George Washington, to me, of all the founders, was the greatest when it comes to private virtue. Sometime before the age of 16, he copied a list of rules of civility and decent behavior into his notebook and then proceeded to spend the rest of his life trying to live by that. You can buy all kinds of a collection of all of his 110 rules for himself. And he had those with him all the time and checked them all the time and added to them. So just to share a couple of them, he had some that were just manners-based. In the presence of others, sing not to yourself with a humming noise, nor drum with your fingers or feet. You know, silly stuff like that. But, you know, quite a few, you know, he was always worried about causing problems for someone else when he's in a public situation. And that would bother someone. And then there were other things like, associate yourself with men of good quality if you esteem your own reputation, for it is better to be alone than in bad company. Then another one, when he's speaking of deity, when you speak of God or his attributes, let it be seriously and with reverence. And then the last one that I love, labor to keep alive in your breast that little spark of celestial fire called conscience. And he said that more than anything else, I mean, he was general, he was president of the United States, but he said, "I hope I shall possess firmness and virtue enough to maintain what I consider the most enviable of all titles, the character of an honest man." He also said that, Abigail Adams described him this way, "Mark his majestic fabric. He is a temple, sacred from his birth and built by hands divine." Okay, and I wanted to show you this, running out of time here, but I love this. How many of you have seen John Adams, the film? You ought to watch it.
General, if you will please place your left hand on the Bible and raise your right hand. Repeat after me. I, George Washington, do solemnly swear. That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Faithfully execute of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend. The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States. So help me God. It is done.
God bless George Washington, President of the United States.
This sorry to rush you through that. He chose to have the scriptures open to Genesis 49. I'll allow you to go home and read that yourselves. And he was the one who added, "So help me God." That was not part, that's not in the Constitution. And then he bent over and kissed the scriptures. And that, for me, that act was a defining act for Washington, if you wanted to know about his character, because humility is at the core of virtue. So, this virtue signaling, I just discovered this is a new thing. And it's that you signal how virtuous you are. And this is environmental virtue right here. But true virtue never signals itself. It was said of George Washington, "I knew no man who so carefully guarded against the discoursing of himself or his acts. If a stranger to his person were present, he would never have known from anything said by the president that he was conscious of having distinguished himself in the eyes of the world." Couldn't we all be like that? Choosing private virtue, every generation has to be taught this. This is not something we're born with. Washington believed that the success of the revolution against England, and that was then the superpower of the world, depended on the help of divine providence. The people would need to choose to live virtuously to have his help. And as general, he forbade all of his officers and soldiers from playing at cards, dice, or criminal gaming, and he consistently worked with his men so that they could eradicate the profane cursing and drinking. He often issued orders, setting aside a day for fasting and prayer, and asked the soldiers if they would please implore God to pardon their sins, and that if it would please him to bless the Continental Army with his divine protection. The colonials believed that they needed to prove themselves worthy of God's help. So religion taught citizens to reward their appetites, steward their appetites, their desires, their general affairs in a moral fashion, and moral people needed neither police nor any form of force to compel them to do the things that they ought to do. It was this tendency of religion to point men outside of themselves to their duties rather than their desires that made it a powerful force on the side of morality and on the side of liberty. Samuel Adams said, "We may look up to armies for our defense, but virtue is our best security." Let's see, do I have time? I don't have time for this. You'll have to watch that. It's on the History Channel. John Adams said the Americans of his day had the most radical sense of liberty, the highest reverence for virtue, and they had descended from a race of heroes, referring to the Pilgrims and the Puritans. That Americans of his day had become more attentive to their liberties, more inquisitive about them, and more determined to defend them than they ever have been known to before. And I think that you would agree that today we've lost a lot of that sentiment and much of the liberty that the founders had and sacrificed themselves for. And doesn't it stand to reason that if we somehow are going to recalibrate America, that we must know what the founders themselves knew and live by the same principles that the founders live by? Samuel Adams said, "While the people are virtuous, they cannot be subdued. But once they lose their virtue, they will be ready to surrender their liberties to the most external or internal invader. If virtue and knowledge are diffused among the people, they will never be enslaved." And then finally, you've probably heard this before, but it's inscribed on the walls of Jefferson Memorial. "The God that gave us life gave us liberty. And can the liberties of a nation be thought secure when we have removed their only firm basis, a conviction in the minds of the people that these liberties are a gift from God, that they are not to be violated, but with his wrath. Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever." So no nation can withstand the forces that are unleashed by the disintegration of truth. And it's up to us to do our homework, to make truth our worldview, and to share it with others and to defend our liberty. Thank you for having me.